This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by YouTube.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello, and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Danielle Abril, Tech at Work writer for the Washington Post. Today marks the latest installment of our series, Race in America. We'll speak with two entrepreneurs about the impact of the pandemic, the country's racial reckoning, and much more. I'd like to welcome our first guest, Tristan Walker, CEO and founder of Walker & Company Brands. Welcome to Washington Post Live, Tristan.
Hey, Danielle. How's it going?
It's going good. It's good to see you. I want to just jump into your entrepreneurial journey. Your first brand, Bevel, it aims to address the lack of health and personal care products for Black men. I'd like to ask you, you know, what led you to start a company that would fill that gap?
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy to me that for an industry that's been around for hundreds of years, Black men weren't getting served. I wasn't getting served. For 15 years, I could not shave. Every single way I encountered facial hair removal was terrible. And I felt for an audience that is so culturally influential, for an audience that has the purchasing power to kind of buy great products for them, for an audience that is growing fast in this country demographically, I felt that it was a wide open opportunity to build an ambitious company that served the unique needs of this consumer audience. And that's exactly what we did.
Your company went on to raise millions of dollars from investors, and it was later acquired by the giant Procter & Gamble in 2018. Yet raising capital was still somewhat difficult. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your journey and why you think those issues came up.
Yeah, look, I mean, first and foremost, most folks that are in the capital interests do not reflect the diversity of the consumers that we hope to serve, right? Look, we are a company that's serving folks of color who will be the majority of this country in 20, 30 years. But the investor class, when I think about general partners and venture capital firms, they do not reflect that growing diversity. So it was difficult to raise money from folks that really didn't understand the consumer need as intimately as I. Additionally, we're up against, I think, two really important kind of features or bugs in the system. The first is laziness, and second is stubbornness. We all know the data that's out there. More diverse opportunities, investing in diverse opportunities can lead to more profits, right? Having more diverse teams can lead to more profits. And folks still choose to not make those investments. So either it's laziness and stubbornness or something more sinister at play. If we all know that investing in these opportunities yield better outcomes economically for us. So those are the two things that I think we ran into, not only when we were starting to raise money, but even to this day, folks having less of a belief in kind of the opportunity ahead of us. But that's fine, because I think that there's an emerging kind of investor class that understands these things a little bit more authentically than the folks that were investing in this sort of thing 10 years ago.
So along the same lines, when it comes to pitching your business, you were pitching to a lot of folks that don't represent the diverse consumers that you're targeting. So how do you actually get your message across to that group?
Look, I mean, at some point, you can't continue to repeat yourself to folks that are unwilling to understand what you're hoping to accomplish. You know, I'll give you a perfect example that I like to share when I talk about this. It was my very first pitch, actually. I was nervous, as most entrepreneurs were, but I was pretty confident about what we had in front of us. You know, I had a 15-slide pitch deck, and I had one slide that showed Proactive, the acne system, on one side of the slide. And then on the other side of the slide, it showed Bevel. Bevel is a brand that helps eliminate razor bumps on men's faces, right? So Proactive is well known for its reduction of acne, right? So I thought that those two systems that we were creating were fairly similar in construct. So at an investor on the other side of the table, the investor kind of leaned in and said, Tristan, I'm not sure solving issues related to razor bumps will have as big an impact as solving issues related to acne. At which point, I kind of understood what that person is saying, but then I just thought in my head, all that person had to do was get on the phone with 10 Black folks, and 8 of them would have said that this is a pretty persistent issue. And let's just say you didn't know 10 Black folks, which is a problem all in of itself. You get on the phone with 10 non-Black folks, and 4 to 5 of them would have said the exact same thing. So there was this kind of forming of an opinion that was not informed, even if they didn't have the authentic connection to that idea. And that goes back to this laziness thing. So the solution was to continue to pitch. And at some point, we found a number of investors that got it and were willing to make those phone calls.
And you mentioned this, that, you know, these struggles aren't something that happened just in your early days. Perhaps they're even continuing. Do you think the sentiment is changing or improving at all?
I'd like to hope so. Look, I mean, the thing that I say for companies, investors, if you're not focused on this imperative for the next 20 years, you're not going to be around 20 years from now. Yeah, I think the largest companies really need to think about this in a unique and intimate way. You know, I think about some of the largest companies that we know. Take a Facebook, for instance, right? In a world where the majority of the world are folks of color, the majority of this country will be people of color in 20, 30 years. You know, if Facebook were built in the year 2040 instead of the year 2004 when it was, you know, I think about a few questions, right? Would it be Spanish language first or English first, right? How would it have been developed? Would it have been at the time iPhone first or Android first? Right. These are kind of real system change questions that we need to be thinking about right now and implementing for the very long term. Right. And for folks that aren't thinking about it, that's fine. I just fundamentally believe that they're just not going to be around 20, 30 years from now. And there's going to be a new crop of companies that get that and kind of take their share.
That's a great transition into the racial reckoning that's going on, and I want to explore that a little bit with you. You've long said that companies need to create more products for customers of color and also have more diverse leadership. Do you think that George Floyd's death created a new sense of urgency for that? And how do you feel about the pace of change currently?
I think so. And it's really fascinating because I see it, especially in my kind of public board directorships that I sit on. You see shareholders making this a very important imperative, right? And when I think about the real imperative behind retail investors and supporting companies that believe in the same values that they have, you're starting to see it manifest in a really kind of positive way. The thing that I've been inspired by, at least over the past 18 months or so, is that I think that there's more acknowledgement of the trauma that Black folks have had to face over the past few hundred years, right? But acknowledgement isn't enough. Once you've acknowledged it, you have to really model the way, right? And the only way to model the way is to really understand and appreciate and execute against the values that you have, not only for your company, but the people within it. I think all too often after the acknowledgement, folks try to go to action, and it's impossible to act without knowing what your values are. Right. So I think that there are a lot of companies trying to feel their way through what that modeling looks like, redefining and getting more precise about those values. But I am intrigued and inspired by the fact that we are forcing companies to start to ask that of themselves. So I think the pace of change could always be faster, but progress is good, at least in this domain.
So speaking of modeling this, I'm curious how you use your platform or how you think you can use your platform to affect change.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've been doing this for the past, 10 plus years of my career. You know, this is nothing new for me. I've dedicated my life to this. You know, as I think about Walker & Company, since our starting, we've been acknowledging this difference and this trauma and developing solutions against it, right? It's not only important for our consumers, but our people at our company, right? I lead a company that's majority folks of color, majority Black folks in positions of leadership at my company. So I think that acknowledgement is important, not only externally, but internally. When I think about modeling the way from the starting of our company, we've articulated and defined 6 values at this company that have persisted through the entire life of our company: courage, inspiration, respect, judgment, wellness, loyalty. You know, we make our decisions in line with those values, right? And then once we have articulated those as we have, then we can act, right? So I'll give you a number of examples. Throughout the past 18 months, you know, we've done things in support of the community in line with those values. For example, last year, late last year, an acknowledgement of some of the mental health trauma that Black folks have faced, particularly in a post-George Floyd world, but kind of writ large. We partnered with the app Headspace, the mental health app Headspace, to offer free memberships for our community, right? If we're a personal care brand delivering personal care solutions for our community, it doesn't have to be soaps and oils, right? But it can also be things that kind of aid them in their own mental health. At the start of the pandemic, when we realized that, there's going to have to be a lot of virtual learning at home, we partnered with Urban Prep Academies in Chicago to offer students kind of free laptops, because we knew that there's going to be disparities of access, right? These are things that, we have been doing since the start of the company. They're a part of what we do, and it didn't take these traumatic events to cause us to want to do them. They were systematized from the very beginning at our company because we know that we have the platform to do that as authentically as possible, and our consumers demand that of us.
So some retailers are making commitments to stock 15% of their shelves with products made by Black-founded companies. I'm curious, what's your reaction to that?
I think it's a great start. One thing that I like to say is, we can do more than 15%, I think. In a world where, folks of color, again, will be the majority of this country in 20, 30 years, folks of color are not only 15% of the consumer impact in this world, right? And I think that there is an opportunity for us to really right-size share of shelf with cultural impact. The 15% is a wonderful start. And I think it's my job, our team's job, our consumers' job and responsibility to show these retailers what our cultural impact and influence actually is and kind of force that kind of right sizing. But I'm grateful, and I think consumers are grateful, that folks are starting to have this conversation, but it's just a start.
Makes sense. And earlier this year, we interviewed City CFO Mark Mason on Washington Post Live here, and he gave corporate America a D in its goals to work towards greater diversity, inclusion, and racial equality. What grade would you give corporate America, and what do you think it'll take to get an A?
Great question. I think for the companies that I've been able to associate myself with, I think they've all been doing a really wonderful job, right? I've been very deliberate about kind of working with folks that really take a care and take an intellectual honesty in having this conversation. I think kind of corporate policy writ large, I think that D is appropriate. Now, what does it take to get better? Number one, you got to diversify these boards, right? When I think about corporate governance, right, it's important that whether it be folks of color or kind of different genders have a seat at that table, right? To establish systems of governance that can be equitable for all, right? When I think about the financial interest, there needs to be kind of lower barriers to entry of participation so that we can invest in companies like Walker & Company in the future. We need to have, DEI HR teams that are thinking about kind of equity, not as just an HR consideration, but a cross-functional consideration, not only in HR, but marketing and operations, et cetera. So this is a true activity system approach that I think is going to take some time for all these corporations to get to that A. I think it is possible. It is not immediately so. But I think that D is appropriate. But I think that there's a wonderful path to that A that we could all lead into.
So you kind of touched on this in the last question, so hopefully we can just dig a little further into it. But your company is comprised of mostly people of color. I'm curious what advice you have for companies of all sizes looking to diversify their workplace.
Yeah, I mean, number one, say it out loud. I mean, it's one thing for you to think it, it's one thing for you to say it and write it down and document it. I think one thing that served us well is, before I started the company, I mentioned I wrote down our values, right? Courage, inspiration, respect, judgment, wellness, loyalty. Those are my personal values too. I define them. We make sure that we recruit, candidates that kind of show us that they embrace those things. We'll ask leading questions to get at your courage and your loyalty and your respect. when we do semi-annual annual reviews, you're rated against your kind of attainment of your quantitative goals, but also your adherence to those values. And the wonderful thing about each of those values is that they are not gender specific. They are not ethnicity specific, right? And I was very, very deliberate about kind of having a welcoming set of values. And as a result, I think that really served us well to diversify our own workforce. So it's important not only for the executive leadership within these companies, but also the folks that are not in positions of leadership to question what those values actually are. Is the company actually following them? And what are the metrics to help you know whether or not that's happening or not? And I think a lot of folks might wake up and realize that they are in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there are companies like ours that might be better served partnering.
I want to jump into your background a little bit. You grew up in Queens, New York, and you said that for you, entrepreneurship was born out of necessity. How did necessity shape your ambition?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wanted to get wealthy. Where I grew up, there are only a few ways to do it. Be an actor or an athlete. It didn't work out for me too well. Second was to work on Wall Street, which I tried. I was terrible at it. And entrepreneurship was really the last way to do it. And the thing that I've realized over time as I've gotten older is that it was less about the wealth and more about the autonomy and ownership and what that can create. You know, it wasn't until that I had the great fortune to partner with Procter & Gamble that I realized and recognized what that meant for me. To me, entrepreneurship is an opportunity for freedom, right? You know, it wasn't until that, you know, we had the merger of our company that I really realized what freedom really meant. And freedom means, to me, not owing anybody anything, right? And when you own, right, you only owe it to yourself to do the right thing, not only for your business results, but also your people, right? So entrepreneurship, for me, kind of started with the output, right? Like get wealthy. And as I've gotten older and I've managed the company, I started to focus a lot more on the inputs to get to that output. And fortunately, ownership is an important input to that kind of real true output of freedom that I really wanted. And I'm thankful to have kind of gone through that experience to come to that conclusion. So my necessity was really freedom.
So we have time for one more question, and I just want to talk about sort of what's happening now. You're now in Atlanta. First of all, what took you there, and what are you seeing as far as entrepreneurship there today?
Sure. So, you know, personal and professional reasons, in Atlanta, this is where our consumers are, right? We have such a density of consumers with cultural influence in this region. Also, you know, I think Atlanta is the most important city in the world right now. I think Atlanta has such a wonderful density of entrepreneurial energy, cultural connection, corporate density, right? When I think about Fortune 500s, some 17, 18 Fortune 500s here, right? And academia. And I think that there are a few regions on earth that have as much density around those three things as Atlanta. So I'm very, very excited about what it has to offer. And then personally, I'm raising two young Black boys, and I want them to be raised in an environment where they can see Black success. And Atlanta is a quintessential platform for that observation for them and my family writ large. So I think the combination of those two things put us in the epicenter of something that feels very special and will continue to. And I think we've made the absolute right choice.
What a great way to end this. I mean, representation really does matter. So good way to end this conversation. That's all the time we have for this. Thank you so much, Tristan, for joining us. I'll be back with Kumar, chef and co-owner of Garland, an acclaimed restaurant in North Carolina, in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
The following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post Newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
Hi, I'm Brittany Luce, host of The Upload, The Rise of the Creator Economy, a podcast from YouTube in partnership with National Public Media. And I'm here today with content creator Randy Lau of the fantastic YouTube channel Made with Lau. Randy, welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. It's really great to be here talking with you.
Wonderful. Well, to jump right in just a few words, could you describe Made with Lao, your YouTube channel?
Made with Lao is a Chinese family recipe channel. We share my dad's recipes. He's been a Chinese chef for over 50 years, and he's just this incredibly talented chef. He knows well over 1,000 recipes. So each week we share one of his recipes, and then we sit down together to eat it as a family. And it's just this, for me, a personal passion project to document my dad's recipes. In the broader world at large, it's just a way to preserve Cantonese heritage and to share it with the world.
That's so amazing. You know, Randy, before you launched Made with Lao, you had a completely different career. Like, talk to me about what motivated you to switch careers and start this channel where you're essentially getting paid to document your family's history.
Yeah, so before this, I was pretty deep into the tech startup world and digital marketing. Video was a very serious hobby of mine, but I never thought to pursue it as a career. And then the pandemic just wiped out our main source of income. So I was just figuring out, what do we need to do next? And it kind of just, long story short, we just decided to go all in on this YouTube idea. And it's been a really great move for our family ever since.
It seems like it's been a pretty great move for your family. So, just a moment ago, I mentioned that you're getting paid basically to document your family's history. But to put it more concretely, your YouTube channel is a real business. And, you're not alone in that. In 2020 alone, YouTube's creative ecosystem contributed over $20 billion to the United States GDP. I mean, that's a really big deal. Talk to me about how your channel turns a profit and how you guys have been able to support yourselves via your YouTube channel.
Yeah, so initially when I was pitching this idea to my parents, they were a little hesitant, but I was like, it's gonna take a long time to start monetizing and turning this into a business we can survive off of. But 2.5 months in, we started monetizing, and that first day we made $3.57, and I was like, yes, but not a lot in the Bay Area. Now fast forward a little over a year, we're earning multiple six figures annually, and it's just been kind of mind blowing to know what opportunities are out there as a content creator. The main revenue streams for us are YouTube AdSense, that's a huge one. We also have our blog at madewithlao.com where we host all of our recipes. We also monetize that through ads. Sponsored content is another big revenue stream where, we'll work with brands to promote their products in our videos. And beyond that, I listed three, and there's tons, way more opportunities and revenue streams to be manifested on YouTube. So there's so many opportunities as a content creator.
One last question. Something I find so compelling about Make with Lao is how you and your family have achieved so much success while staying true to yourselves and centering your culture for a wider audience instead of translating it. I wonder, what's the unique opportunity for on YouTube for creators of color or people from other marginalized backgrounds?
Yeah, I think traditionally, storytelling has been gatekept by big companies in the media. And I think YouTube is, from the beginning, has been this platform and tool that's kind of democratized storytelling for a lot of people. And you combine that with, at least for Asian Americans, the success of, shows like Squid Game or Shang-Chi. I think there's a growing appetite for a more diverse set of voices. So I think now is kind of the perfect storm more than ever to become a content creator. And I think, for any type of business, I think it's just really an exchange of value. And, whether you're selling something or whether you're creating content, I think it's just, YouTube is a really great way to discover what your value is and what you can bring to the world. And YouTube is, as a platform, is really great at funneling that value that you bring to people who will enjoy that. And, I think it's just a really good time to start and to start experimenting.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for talking with me today. It has been great.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to get to share.
And now, back to Washington Post Live.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Daniela Brill, tech writer at The Washington Post. I'm pleased to introduce our next guest, Chidi Kumar. She is chef and co-owner of Garland, an acclaimed restaurant in North Carolina. Chidi, welcome to Washington Post Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. That intro, you know, really made me hungry watching all those plates on the video. And we'll get to food in a minute, but I want to start off with your entrepreneurial journey. You immigrated from India and you went to the Bronx. You ended up settling in North Carolina. What led you to open up your own restaurant, and what were the biggest challenges in making that decision?
I have a very convoluted path to a restaurant owner here. I chose Raleigh as my home because it was the first place in America that I felt at home. And a big part of that was the music community here. People in bands just had a lot of almost entrepreneurial spirit, a real DIY determination. But then there was also a farmer's market that was, you know, 2 miles from downtown and open every single day. And it really reminded me of the farmer's market in Chandigarh in India, where I grew up. And then on the other side of town, there were all of these Asian and Indian markets. So I really felt like, you know, at that point, Raleigh was still kind of sleepy and it wasn't in all of these lists of the best place to live in America. But I could have told you that, you know, there was something about to happen here, and there was a spirit of simultaneously determination, but also ease and a community that really valued creativity, I felt. So that's sort of what brought me here. And then initially I was just playing music, I was managing bands, and in order to support my you know, somewhat of a career playing music and being on tour, being a recording and touring musician, I was bartending in restaurants. And eventually that led to opening a music venue. And then that led to opening a restaurant in the same building as a music venue. So it was a real backwards path. I didn't really, you know, pursue it as a career option. It was almost sort of like an accidental jump off a cliff. And then I found myself in this, you know, very much enmeshed in the restaurant world.
Wow, that's quite a path you took to get here, but looks like you found what you're hoping to do. I want to talk a little bit about the role of food. Food just plays such a big role in so many cultures. I'm curious about if you could tell me a little bit more about the significance of opening a restaurant and the role food plays for you.
I think, you know, when we moved from America to America from India, it's tough. You know, I think any person who has left their country and come to a new land, you know, at the age of 8 or 4 or 15, whatever it is, it's very difficult. And, you know, as a family, we didn't really have any financial security. We lived in a small apartment, 2 bedrooms with 3 kids. And I know, especially now that I have the sort of insight of an adult, I can look back and say, wow, my parents were completely depressed and anxiety ridden. But the only thing that really felt normal and felt, you know, nurturing and nourishing was dinner. And my mom was very dedicated to making sure that, you know, we had a home cooked meal all together every night. Whether, you know, all the circumstances leading up to that were horrible, while we were eating and enjoying food, we were enjoying it. And so that was like a little blip of happiness in an otherwise not so great, you know, childhood for several years. So food, also became a source of connection for each other within the family. But then I, you know, also finally started making friends, and all of my friends were from different backgrounds because I had the privilege of, you know, being in New York City, which was very diverse. So I would go to my friends' houses for lunch or apartments for lunch, and, you know, one person was Korean and another one was Puerto Rican and the other one was Greek. And so everybody's refrigerator was completely different than mine, but we also had this thing in common where, you know, our food was like stinky and we maybe all felt a certain amount of shame about like what our moms packed for us for lunch, and we could hide together and enjoy this incredible food. And so I realized how much, you know, food really represents a sense of place and can can be a source of connection or isolation, depending on how you look at it. But overall, I just started really becoming fascinated by the commonalities that people have in different cultures using spices. And it just led me down this very nerdy historical anthropological path. And I started studying recipes pretty much, you know, when I was a kid, collecting cookbooks from the public library book sales and, you know, just sort of seeing a lot of commonalities. And my mom was pretty adventurous too. So every time we'd go to a restaurant, she'd be like, it's not that good. I could do it better. And then she'd like interpret it in her own way. So she was really good at digging into recipes. And I learned a lot about that from her. So it established an identity in an otherwise foreign land, I guess, for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to just interject and say stinky food always means tasty food. So if you're ever around stinky food, just know it's good.
Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. You testified before Congress earlier this year, and I want to read something that you said before Congress. You said the restaurant industry is full of stories like you, and also, quote, restaurants represent America more than any other industry. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I think, you know, on so many levels, we could break down how the restaurant industry represents America. I think the health of the restaurant industry and the food system in general is a mirror for our economic health, for where our priorities are, for, you know, everything from job numbers to supply chain issues to the labor market to the health of a community. I think oftentimes you'll find that a up-and-coming neighborhood doesn't become up-and-coming until somebody takes a chance on a corner that was previously, you know, maybe an undesirable part of town. And some young entrepreneur will say, I'm going to put a small eatery here, and then everything kind of grows up around it. So on the local sense, restaurants establish anchors in communities and neighborhoods. They employ people from that area. They support a lot of small regional other businesses and other industries. And so therefore, the restaurant is sort of creates a rippling effect. It's the ship in the middle of a body of water, and everything around it gets affected by it. So if the restaurant industry isn't healthy, you'll see that there's a lot of unemployment. You'll see that there are supply chain issues. You'll see that there are less small businesses, and small businesses are good for local communities because we tend to spend our money within our community. It retains tax dollars within a certain place. And then on, you know, a cultural side, when people of color and women are taking an opportunity to open a restaurant, oftentimes they're not going through traditional channels of large investors or even banks. These are opportunities that we create out of ourselves and maybe get a loan from a family member or put up our house for a mortgage or all of the above. And what that means is that this is a make or break decision and investment in our life. And we will work tirelessly to make sure that it succeeds. So it's an investment in, you know, in that spot. It's good for the landlords, it's good for the real estate, and for all of those reasons. And then we tend to hire people who maybe look like us, and we understand people who feel displaced. And so we're willing to give a job to people that may not have another place to work. So, you know, when that happens over and over again, it creates a zeitgeist, it creates a cultural movement. And I think that influences the direction of the country and hopefully eventually the policies that support industries like ours.
Well, we know your industry was really hit hard by the pandemic. I want to talk a little bit about the pressures that you faced and some of the things that you learned during this time.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I'd like to say that that's not a past tense. It is definitely ongoing, and nowhere is there an end in sight. In fact, we just had today three cancellation of private parties for December because of the new COVID strain. So this has been something that we've lived with and struggled through for the last 20 months. Almost become like we're literally living with a disease. And aside from the literal sense that, you know, we all as individuals, you know, fear this virus or are afraid for our healths or the healths of our family, it's a daily reality that I think people who own a restaurant are living with, that we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how long this is going to go on. And aside from just, the emergency, quote unquote, part of it from March until whenever, depending on where you were in this country of last year, all of those pivots that we did, you know, we tried takeout, even though we were not a takeout restaurant. We did meal kits for 4 months. We tried all of these different ways of operating that were safer, that would allow us to keep some of our staff and then grow judiciously and not pretend like everything was okay when it wasn't, to predict what might come in 3 months. But it also obviously has affected the supply chain. So everything from, you know, vinyl or latex gloves, which, you know, every restaurant has to use by the case full, the price of that is still double than what it was before the pandemic. And it's been tripled before. Fryer oil, you know, people who rely on commodity products, which we don't as much in our restaurant because we source so much locally, but meat is expensive. Everything is so much more expensive, and there are no, the labor shortage has always been a plague for our restaurant industry, but it's out of control now. I mean, it's just really difficult. There's no security, and we're used to living with that level of, no safety net as business owners, as small business owners. But now it really feels like, you know, a train is coming right behind you and you better outrun it all the time. So we're, I think, kind of getting used to living with this high level of anxiety, which, you know, I'm not sure how much, you know, emotional and psychological reserves people like us have left to continue, you know, living with this all the time.
Boy, that sounds so tough. I hear about all these challenges you just mentioned, and it's just one after another after another. Can you give us a sense of what is the state of the industry right now, and how does that play out for smaller restaurants? I mean, it sounds pretty grim based on what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it is pretty grim. I've been working with the Independent Restaurant Coalition since last year, and there are initiatives that have helped us. The first, the PVP and the IDLE grants, and most significantly, the Restaurant Relief Fund, the RRF grant. But that only helped a third of the people that applied for it. So as small independent restaurants, oftentimes we are single shops or two or three shops. We're not large corporations with investors. So it's to say that it's bleak is not really an exaggeration at all. I think two thirds of the restaurants in this country that haven't even gotten a grant, I think that they count day by day, how many more days they can stay open. They owe their landlords so much money. It's hard to get supplies. It's hard to get staff. After a while, you can endure a storm for only so long. And then after a while, you're just like, I don't know if this is, you know, I'm not able to support my family, for example. So I think that, for this industry, federal help is so important. I think that local help is important because we do contribute so much money to the tax revenue on a local, state, and national level. So I don't know. Without that, I'm not really sure how we can recover, because it doesn't seem like the pandemic is really going to go away anytime soon, unfortunately. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you guys get some more help, because I know I'm a big fan of my local spots, and I'm sure everybody in your hometown is as well. I want to sort of stress the importance of these small restaurants. And so I want to explore with you, you know, what role food and culture can play, especially in the country's racial reckoning right now.
I think, you know, it's such a deeply complex issue. For me, when we opened Garland, when I opened Garland, it's almost been 8 years. I really struggled so hard with the identity of the restaurant. What category is it? You know, I really, my motivation and my creative inspiration comes from our local ingredients. And it also comes from me studying parts of India and Asia that I don't really know about. I mean, they're, you know, it's not like, well, I grew up in India for 8 years. I lived in this one town. I know everything about Indian food. That's not even like remotely true. It's like saying somebody in Sicily is required to know everything about German food. It's just not practical. But I think there is a, I'm not sure what the word is, like a one-dimensionaling of people of color when it comes to expression of food. So, you know, somebody from China, even though they might have grown up in America, if they open a restaurant, there's somewhat of an expectation that they're going to represent their entire heritage and their culture. And, you know, you feel that about yourself too. Like, am I being true to my mom's recipes? Am I being true to my grandmother's recipes? There's all this internal struggle that I don't think anybody who identifies as Caucasian in this country ever has to worry about it. You know, there could be somebody who grew up in Iowa and, you know, is multi-generational white, and they decide to study Asian and Indian food, and they'd be hailed as being super creative. Whereas if I try to, you know, incorporate other parts of Asia or even Southern traditions, sort of like, you know, what am I? Like, what, you know, what Yelp category do I put down? What category on Facebook am I allowed to say? Can I say that I'm New American? I don't know. Then people are going to expect to have certain things on the menu. There's, so, I mean, that's just like one example of how rigid people think about, you know, food. And I think hopefully in the last year, we're starting to see that racial identity and roles are not boxes. You know, this is a fluid culture, and that is the beauty of our culture. It's as long as we keep everybody in a box, we're never going to get out of this, I think, kind of dark time. It's really crucial that we welcome people into this country like we always have. And then when we get them here, that they're allowed to forge an identity for themselves that feels right to them, and then also kind of ripens our entire culture. And then on the other side of it, you know, there's a certain level of distrust that I had from, you know, partners that I thought were my friends who decided that a restaurant should be profitable in 6 weeks and told me that I was too emotional about my business. And, you know, I was like, oh my God, maybe I am. Maybe I'm supposed to be more like, you know, black and white and like very pragmatic about everything. And, you know, it took me several months of like an internal struggle to say, no, me being emotional about my business is what gives me the fire and the passion to really own it. And I can be pragmatic about the numbers, but I cannot be pragmatic about the vision that I have for my restaurant and for my business. And that was something that was really isolating for me, because I didn't know who to ask if it was okay for me to feel so emotional about it. I live and breathe this business. And that is what actually helped me save the business several times over in moments of utter terror and despair. And that's what really fuels me now. So, I think there are a lot of comfort levels that we don't get to have as non-male identifying, non-white identifying people. And I'm not saying that it's the same for me as it is for a black person who has grown up in this country and seen a different level or a different, has had a different experience, but there is an othering that we have to come to terms with. And I think food is the most, it's an olive branch. It's a way of, you know, inviting a willing participant into that conversation without it being overtly about that conversation, I guess.
Yeah, food is a great connector. I know that's the case, at least for me. Chidi, I want to end with a little bit of advice to aspiring entrepreneurs, especially other women of color. And I'm curious, what would you tell them as they begin their journey?
I think it's important to study a little bit about what it is that you expect. I had a lot of naivete. I literally jumped off a cliff, and I'm glad I did, because I think if I thought about it too much, I might have changed my mind. But I think getting a little bit of financial literacy is very intimidating. And that's the part that always nags you in the beginning. Like, I'm not sure I know what it's supposed to be like. There are resources out there that you can get and at least know what your goals are and know that it's going to take you a while to get there. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not doing everything wrong. Understand what your priorities are and figure out how you can most capitalize yourself, be as well-funded as you possibly can, and learn to sort of like live with your fear. The fear is going to be there, and it's normal and it's natural. You just can't let it guide you. It's just it's your passenger for a long time, and you just get used to saying, okay, well, I'm scared. Yep. Everything is terrifying, but that's all right. It doesn't matter. I'm going to stay with that and keep going. And you learn to hone your instincts that way and lead with your gut and know that it's going to be hard work, but you're going to figure out the best way for you. And what works for you doesn't work for anybody else. And what works for everybody else may not work for you. So it's really important to like find your own way and don't give up and know that you have to work all the time.
Yeah, that's some great advice to end on. Chidi, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights. This is really valuable.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.